Good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. My name is James White, and we are live here on the internet, and I hope everyone is able to tune in today. We are we're doing something new today. Yes, indeed. We have actually allowed Rich Pierce out of his dungeon. He has been allowed out of the Alpha and Omega Ministries dungeon, and he and his family have actually gone on a vacation. They're on their way back, but what that means is that we do be winging it, and the captain's chair has been filled by Lieutenant Sulu. Lieutenant Sulu is in charge of the ship today. Warren Smith is sitting there going, okay, he says it's way too loud in his headphones. What do I do about that? Oh, his ears are bleeding. Oh, that's not a good thing. And so we have him very worried over there that something desperate is going to happen. So when folks start calling in, please be kind to Warren, because Warren is doing his best Windows impersonation today. He is multitasking, and so we need to be nice to Warren, because you know what happens when you're not nice to Windows. You get the blue screen of death, and if I just hear the door close and silence on the other side, then we'll know that Warren also just sort of walked away as well. So that's sort of how it might might work, and that really would not be a good thing. So actually, we should just have everybody call in all at once and just see how much she can actually handle. I did that to a Windows system once. You know, how many programs can you actually throw at a computer before it just, you know, ups and dies? And maybe that's what we can do. If everyone starts calling in at 866-854-6763 all at the same time, and then he'll be sitting there going, yeah. So anyways, everybody's hearing us, and in fact, we're doing better than we've done for weeks, when you think about it. In fact, I could think of someone out there probably hoping that everything's going to just die all of a sudden, because if we make it through this perfectly, I can guarantee there's going to be someone going, you know, so on and so forth. Anyways, no, there was no program last week. Those of you who have been griping and complaining and wondering, there was no program last week, because we couldn't do a program last week. I suppose we could have asked Warren to come in and set up the stream, and then come in here and do the program and talk, and then when the calls came in, he could say, hold on a second, run over to the next room and take the calls and do things like that, but that probably wouldn't have been a really good idea either. And we couldn't do it from up there in Salt Lake City. We don't have the ability to remote broadcast in that way. I suppose if Rich was here and I was up there, then certainly we could do it, but we weren't able to do that. We were in Salt Lake City last week. We did something we hadn't done. I don't know. We were sitting in the car wondering about how long it had been. It was somewhere around 94, 95, maybe 96, somewhere along in the middle 90s. We stopped driving to Salt Lake City, and we started flying. And that's been nice, because it's 654 miles to Salt Lake City. That's, depending on how fast you're driving, anywhere from a 9-hour to a 12-hour drive, and also how long you stop to eat, and whether you just do drive-thrus, and how fast you fill up the gas tank, and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And, of course, at least since the middle 90s, the speed limits went up, and so that does cut it down just a little bit. But it's still a pretty long drive from Phoenix to Salt Lake City. And starting in 1984, we drove that all the time, twice a year. That's 4 times a year we would drive up to Salt Lake City. And after a while, especially after you go through Panguitch, Utah. Actually, there's a couple really dry spots along the way. Once you get out of Flagstaff and you're on the Navajo Reservation up to up toward Page, you just can't look at a whole lot of red rocks. I mean, after a while, okay, I've seen enough, and they all look the same now, and it gets a little boring. And there's always you could make the quick stop at that metropolitan mecca of tourism called the Gap up there on the reservation. That would always be an enjoyable thing to do. And in fact, I stopped there one night. I was driving up. Why was it nighttime? I forget why it was, but I was driving. I was driving my 1970, what was it, 74 VW Beetle. It was a Sunbug. It was gold. And I remember pulling into the Gap around midnight and sleeping for a couple hours there in the Gap. I was all alone, and that was a really dumb thing to do, to drive up there all alone. But anyways, I did it. Well, anyhow, and then once you go up through Panguitch, Utah, you go over on this little 20. It's about 20 miles, and it's 20. Takes you over to I-15. And from I-15 up until about Provo, it's just... one of those trips. Just it's really about as exciting as back in the Navajo Reservation. And then you start getting into some city traffic and stuff. But anyways, we hadn't done that in a long, long time. But in light of September 11th, and we thought for a while we were going to be videotaping the debate that was going to take place Friday night. We decided not to do that. I think we could have. It wouldn't have made any difference. But the point was, when we take these flights, frequently we do them standby, and we carry on a bunch of stuff. Well, right now that's not a good thing. You know, I mean, we might still be standing in line if we had tried to do that. So we decided to drive. And so Rich Pierce and Larry Vondra and myself, we left right after I got done teaching high school classes Thursday morning. Actually, it would have been a little bit afternoon. We got started. I sat in the back and graded high school papers and turned in grades via the phone. And in fact, at one point, I demonstrated that I'm a complete techno geek by getting into our chat room via my cell phone on my laptop in the back of the car outside of Flagstaff. Now, I was only there for about 5 minutes, but it was enough to impress the other techno geeks in the chat room that I am the king of techno geeks, because nobody else had ever done that. I did it first, and everybody else is going, well, I could have if I had wanted to, but they didn't. And so anyways... And so we got up there on Thursday, and then Friday evening was the debate. Now, this is somewhat new, and in fact, it's somewhat unusual, because Mormons generally don't do debates. I mean, Van Hale did a debate with Walter Martin back in the 80s, but it's just not as normative as you have with Roman Catholics or things like that. It's just somewhat unusual. And when did we first do it? I guess we've done it each time. No, I think we skipped one. Starting a little while ago, don't remember how long ago, we had a debate with a Roman Catholic in Salt Lake City the night before the conference, which we've never even offered because it really wasn't much of a debate. I mean, my opponent was a former Baptist who became a Roman Catholic. He's an RCIA instructor up there, and it was supposed to be on justification. And in his opening statement, he said things like, well, you know, we all believe the same thing now, thanks to the Lutheran Catholic Accord, and we all believe in justification by faith now. And he even said that Catholics are now allowed to pray to Saint Martin Luther, which, you know, I'm sort of sitting there looking at this guy going, man, this is really weird. In fact, the only notable thing about that entire debate was that some King James only pastor guy tried to trap me afterwards and twisted my words and wrote an article and all the rest of stuff. And it was after that debate. Isn't it interesting that a King James-only pastor would have to come to a Roman Catholic debate to try to trip me up? But anyways, so that was the first debate we did. Then, 6 months ago, we arranged a debate, and Jason Wallace and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church up in Salt Lake City, which you need to pray for, of course, obviously up there, they are. I think they should be considered a foreign missions work, actually. I think anyone doing that kind of church work in Salt Lake City should be considered being a foreign missionary. But anyways, Jason Wallace and the OPC are the folks up there who are sponsoring these debates. And 6 months ago, they contacted Jason. Jason's a nice guy, and he can get on the phone, and he can be very nice. And I guess he's a whole lot nicer than me and sounds a lot nicer than me, because... he would call FARMS, the Foundation for Research and Mormon Studies, and they would say, well, talk to this person, talk to that person, and he'd slowly be handed down the chain until 6 months ago, we had a debate with Richard Hopkins. Now, Mr. Hopkins at the time was the head of Horizon Publishers, and he's written two books. One was called Biblical Mormonism. The other one's about how Greek philosophy has corrupted the Christian view of God, or something along those lines. And I knew Mr. Hopkins. I had been on his radio program about 2 or 3 years before that. In fact, one night I had done a 4-hour marathon on Salt Lake City Radio on a Sunday evening, where we were on for 2 hours with Van Hale and Bill. It's Van Hale and Bill Forrest had the program, but I had not met Bill Forrest until actually last week. And we were on 2 hours with Van Hale and 2 hours with Mr. Hopkins, and turned out to be a very interesting program. But anyways, I knew of him. I knew of his book. I really felt that his book demonstrated he had no concept of what Christian theology actually is, but was unable to convince him of that. And so we had a debate on the nature of man and the issue of free will. And I don't know how many people were there, 120, 140 maybe, I don't know. Maybe less than that. I'm not really sure about that. But anyways, we had the debate, and it went pretty well. You know, for our first run at it, and I think it's pretty unusual in the Salt Lake Valley for there to be a evangelical / Mormon debate, and so it went pretty well. So after that debate, then this next time, I get a call from Jason, and he has arranged to have a debate with Dr. Roger Keller. Now, I was, I'll admit, going up there, I didn't think this was going to work. I didn't think it was going to work for a couple of various and sundry reasons, but I had met Roger Keller once. There's no way he would ever remember me. Because I had met him when I was in college, and I don't look anything like I looked in college, and he looked pretty much the same to me anyways, from what I remember seeing. And he had been out here in Arizona. In fact, I look so little like I did in college that last night was the beginning of my 20th high school reunion, and a fellow that I knew from sixth grade on. We had been best friends in sixth grade and then through junior high school and all the rest of stuff. Walked up to him and he had no idea who in the world I was. Just, I gave him all sorts of hints, told him about trips we had taken together up to Lake Powell and, all this stuff. Still had no idea. When I finally told him, he was like, "You've got to be kidding." Anyways, that is neither here nor there. He wouldn't, of course, remember what I looked like, but I remembered his story. He had been a Presbyterian, a PCUSA minister. And somehow, I'm not sure how, as a PCUSA minister, he had also pastored, as I recall, in a United Methodist church. Now, anybody who knows Presbyterians and Methodists know they're not exactly on the same page theologically, but remember, liberals are liberals, and he was a liberal PCUSA minister, so a liberal PCUSA minister and a liberal United Methodist, what does it matter? You could all, you know, get together, it doesn't really matter. So I had remembered his conversion story. I'd remembered that even while he was a Presbyterian pastor, he was presenting a view of Mormonism that I knew was not what Mormons actually believe, and we had opposed him going around doing that kind of thing. And then I had heard that he had left once he converted to Mormonism. He had left the area and was teaching at BYU, and I really hadn't heard much more about him since then until Jason called me and said, "Well, we've arranged for a debate with Roger Keller." Well, I had his book, Reformed Christians and Mormon Christians, Let's Talk. And I had never really sat down and done much with it. I had sort of skimmed through it and went, "Oh, this is interesting." But so I grabbed that, took it with me on the way up to Salt Lake City, of course. And in the process of reading it, was fascinated at what I was seeing. In fact, even at one point, Oh, I'm sorry. I'm digging a spear out of my back that was thrown by someone in the chat room right now who is complaining that what I sound like I'm doing is like when his wife sits down to talk about a day of shopping. Well, thank you very, very much. If I didn't have to maintain concentration of what I was saying, my little mouse would find a way to go find my pop-ups and send a certain person packing through cyberspace right now for that particular comment. So, anyways, thank you so, so much for your kind comments. in looking through the book, I found it fascinating that when at one point some charts are provided for what salvation is all about, and he even marked the viewpoint that was his at the time as neo-Orthodox. He's got the Mormon, he's got the standard evangelical, and he's got the neo-Orthodox. And that's interesting. And so I start reading through the text. This guy, as a Presbyterian, was a universalist. He was, in fact, during the course of the debate, you've got to try to picture this. Those of you who weren't there, you've got to try to picture this. We next time around, we need to change this because it's a little bit hokey. But we don't have a podium. We have basically a 6-foot table. And the two debaters sit on opposite ends of the well, you don't sit on the table, but you sit at the opposite end of the table. And then Jason Wallace sits in the middle, and he is sort of the stoic moderator type guy. He just sits there and announces what's next and keeps things going and keeps the time, but he stays out of it. Well, at one point during the cross-examination, I was bringing out some of these issues about where he was coming from. And he made the comment, yes, I would take the position of Karl Barth, the happy Calvinist. And as soon as he said Karl Barth, the happy Calvinist, Jason he couldn't help it. He busted up. I mean, he was trying to be, you know, absolutely stoic, but he just busted up. He couldn't handle it, the happy Calvinist. And got a good chuckle out of the audience on that one. Later on, though, in the same interaction, Barth's name came up again, and I forget the exact context, but at some point, I had gotten some laughter going for something I had said, and he made some comment along the lines of, well, yeah, Barth's taken a lot of heat for that. And I said, yeah, literally. And the whole place just broke up laughing hysterically at that particular point. So it was a good interchange at that point. But Dr. Keller, as a Presbyterian, was a very liberal Presbyterian. And not only that, when he would read the Westminster Standards, he brought with him the Westminster Standards. He admitted that as a Presbyterian, he had found the teaching of the Westminster Confession regarding God and his sovereign decree and the issue of reprobation to be monstrous. He as a Presbyterian, he had viewed that as monstrous, as just being horrible. He had never accepted that. So obviously he was never truly a Presbyterian, at least not in the historical sense. There's lots of modern PCUSA Presbyterians, though, that would agree with him. They don't believe that that's what is really taught there anyway. So anyhow, so that was the background. So you've got a liberal Presbyterian who converts to Mormonism. Now, that always confused me. I'll be honest with you. That always confused me. What does Mormonism have to offer to a liberal? And what I didn't understand was the kind of Mormonism that he was converting to. And when you look at his book, he mentions a very interesting fellow. A very interesting fellow that we all know out here in Arizona who goes around and tries to meet with ministers to convince them. His name is Darl Anderson, to convince them that that Mormonism is not what people say that it is. And Darl Anderson had been influential in his conversion. And so in light of that, it started to make some sense as to what was going on. Because the position that Dr. Keller presented in the debate was not what you would hear from the Mormon that you'd be talking to at the Easter pageant, outside your front door, the Mormons that I talk to in Salt Lake City. That's not what you'd be hearing. Instead, you have a liberal Mormonism. Let's give it some examples. During the cross-examination, well, back up. I thought the debate was supposed to be on justification. But when we got there, it was on grace and works. So I did a presentation on justification, in essence, and I don't think anyone realized that there was that much of a difference. And I get done with a 20-minute presentation on justification. Dr. Keller starts his off by saying, well, I'd like to thank Dr. White for pretty much presenting my position for me. And if you know Mormonism, and if you've ever listened, for example, to some of the programs that I've done on the radio in Salt Lake City before, you know that that's not exactly what you expect to hear after an opening presentation on justification. But he basically said, that's pretty much what we believe, you know, it's the atonement central, grace, you know, all the rest of this stuff. And he did then go on to make a few changes. Well, yeah, you can fall from grace and a few things like that. But it was not what you expect to hear from the missionaries, for example. Now, realize this one is standing room only. There's the room is packed out. There's people standing along the back wall because there's no place to sit. So this one is much better attended, and there's a number of LDS missionaries there. And there's a number of ex-Mormons there as well. And I'm watching these folks, and I can tell that for the vast majority of them, they had never heard what he was saying before. The former Mormons are sitting there going, no stinking way. That's not what I was taught. That's not what my bishop ever said. I've never heard this at all. And then you've got the Mormons sitting there going, so this is what they're teaching at BYU now, huh? Very interesting. And so you could tell that there was a lot of befuddlement on both ends in regards to that. Some of the examples. It became incumbent upon me to differentiate the two sides. I was going to have to do the work at that point. And so what I decided to do is, I quoted from Moroni 10:32, 2 Nephi 25:23. These are passages that talk about how if we need to love God with our heart, soul, mind, and strength, rid ourselves of all ungodliness, then his grace is sufficient and all the rest of this stuff. And it's by grace we're saved. After all we can do is what 2 Nephi 25:23 says. And so I started bringing some of these issues up. And he, in his statement, in fact, in his opening statement, had made a comment that from his perspective, Joseph Smith had strengthened Romans 3:28 in the Joseph Smith translation. And by saying by faith alone or something alone, I don't think it was faith alone, faith only, I think is what he had, something along those lines. So since he had brought it up, I brought up the change that Joseph Smith had made, where he indicates in Romans chapter 4, that God does not justify the ungodly. And so I asked him about that, and I said, doesn't this indicate a very different perspective for Joseph Smith than what you're presenting? And his comment was fascinating. His comment was, well, I can think of 6 or 7 colleagues of mine on the faculty of Brigham Young University who really believe that the Joseph Smith translation is an inspired correction of the scriptures, that God is actually having Joseph here correct the scriptures. But that was said in the context of saying the rest of them don't believe that. His perspective was the Joseph Smith translation is a divine commentary. And he specifically made the assertion in the course of the debate, I am certain that Paul wrote exactly what you have in your text, not what Joseph Smith has in a Joseph Smith translation. This is Joseph Smith's inspired commentary. And you could just see people in the audience airing out their tonsils at this point, going, "You really? Wow, I've never heard this before." And then it got patently clear that people were amazed when I finally got hold of the LDS Quad, the Book of Mormon, Dr. Cobb's Prophet Price, and King James Version of the Bible. It's a big, thick, big thing that you can barely carry. And I read the definition of grace that is contained in the Bible dictionary. And it says that grace is an assisting power that helps us do works that we would not be able to maintain otherwise. But grace is not sufficient without our total effort, and hence it gives 2 Nephi 25:23, by grace we saved after all we can do, etc., etc. It gives a very unbiblical definition of grace, and what's more, a definition of grace very different than what Dr. Keller was giving. And without any hesitation, without batting an eye, without any embarrassment, Dr. Keller just smiles and he says, "Well, I know who wrote those." And as you pointed out, he says, "It's not scripture, and I simply reject that." Well, I know who wrote it too. Bruce R. McConkie wrote that section, I'm pretty certain. And Bruce R. McConkie is the apostle that modern Mormons love to hate and to dismiss. And yet, here you have a definition of grace. Now, think about this. A definition of grace written by an alleged apostle, published in the LDS version of the scriptures, under the authority of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And yet I specifically asked him, would it not be fair for me as an outsider to read this source that comes from the general authorities, that's published in the scriptures of the LDS Church under the authority of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, would it not be fair of me to view this as being the normative understanding? And he said, no, it would not. And he rejected that definition of grace. That's what's going on at BYU. And that raises a lot of questions for a lot of folks. It also demonstrates that there's a wide variety of opinions at BYU, and the conservative LDS scholars who are still defending such things as exaltation to godhood and so on and so forth in the full sense of the Joseph Smith meaning, obviously find someone like Dr. Keller and his comments to be disturbing, at the very least. It was very, very interesting, and I think in the long run, a lot of people hearing that are going to go, wow, that's really something else. Well, we need to take our first break coming up here at the bottom of the hour. If you have some questions or comments about our trip up there, I'm going to be talking about some new books coming out, by the way. Those will be coming up in the next half hour. 866-854-6763. 866-854-6763. Let's see how much Warren can do at one time. 866-854-6763. We'll be right back.
What is Dr. Norman Geisler warning the Christian community about in his book, Chosen But Free, A New Cult, Secularism, False Prophecy Scenarios? No, Dr. Geisler is sounding the alarm about a system of beliefs commonly called Calvinism. He insists that this belief system is theologically inconsistent, philosophically insufficient, and morally repugnant. In his book, The Potter's Freedom, James White replies to Dr. Geisler, but the Potter's Freedom is much more than just a reply. It is a defense of the very principles upon which the Protestant Reformation was founded. Indeed, it is a defense of the very gospel itself. In a style both scholars and laymen can appreciate, James White masterfully counters the evidence against so-called extreme Calvinism, defines what the Reformed faith actually is, and concludes that the gospel preached by the Reformers is the very one taught in the pages of Scripture. The Potter's Freedom, A Defense of the Reformation and a Rebuttal to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free by James White. You'll find it in the Reformed Theology section of our bookstore at amen.org.
The Apostle Paul spoke of the importance of solemnly testifying of the gospel of the grace of God. The proclamation of God's truth is the most important element of his worship in his church. The elders and people of the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church invite you to worship with us this coming Lord's Day. Our morning Bible study begins at 9:30 a.m. and our worship service is at 10:45. Evening services are at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday, and Wednesday prayer meeting is at 7. We are located at 3805 North 12th Street in Phoenix. You can call for further information at 26 Grace, or look us up on the web at www.prbc.org.
More than any time in the past, Roman Catholics and evangelicals are working together. They are standing shoulder to shoulder against social evils. They are joining across denominational boundaries in renewal movements. And many evangelicals are finding the history, tradition, and grandeur of the Roman Catholic Church appealing. This newfound rapport has caused many evangelical leaders and laypeople to question the age-old disagreements that have divided Protestants and Catholics. Aren't we all saying the same thing in a different language? By going to our website,
Joseph Smith, the theological implications.
And welcome back to The Dividing Line. My name is James White, filling you in on events from last weekend when we were not here, because we were in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Friday night we had a debate with Dr. Roger Keller. It went really well. I mean, I think Dr. Keller would do it again, and I think the people there thought it went really well. They certainly saw something they rarely see up there. And it certainly introduced a lot of folks to the new Mormonism of Brigham Young University, anyways. And so it went really well. We hope to have tapes fairly soon. We still don't have the tapes from 6 weeks ago. That's neither here nor there. I'm not going to say anything more about that because, you know, some people try real hard, but just anyways, we will have it available, and I think you'll all find it to be most interesting to listen into that. So the next morning, the three of us get up, Rich Pierce, Larry Vondra, and myself, and we head for the general conference. I was a little concerned, to be honest with you. I think I had reason to be concerned about the possibility of some security issues. I mean, it is the way it is in the United States right now, and I was concerned that some cops would come up to us, in essence, and tell us we need to hand out our literature, you know, 14 miles away or something like that. There were more cops there than normal. There were more security than normal, but not that many more. It really, you could not tell from that, anyways, that we are living in post September 11th America, which I think is an accurate way of describing it. But there still were some really weird people up there. Oh, it was strange. We came walking across. There used to be a road that went across what would be called East. It was Main Street. Yeah, it was Main Street. It would be the east side of the Temple Square. And it's been closed off. It's been turned into a park. We call it the No Free Speech Park because somehow the church managed to obtain a road, a street, close it off, turn it into a plaza, and you can't distribute literature there. So it's the No Free Speech Park, and so we walked through there to the corner of North Temple and Main, and from there we could look around and we could see the spot we normally stand on, which is directly across from the North Gate, and we can see signs everywhere. So we automatically know, oh, this is going to be fun. But as we walk toward the spot we normally pass out literature, what do our wondering eyes see? But three groups. There's almost always a group there. of fundamentalist Mormons wearing, well, the one guy wears camouflage pants, and they're protesting abortion. Now, I don't know why they're doing this. I mean, Mormons are generally not, they're generally not in favor of abortion. But these are excommunicated Mormons, polygamists, and they stand there with their signs, and their signs have aborted fetuses on them, and they look really strange, and they're always there. And we don't really talk to them anymore. We had talked to them years and years and years and years ago. But they're there. Then you've got two other groups. Now one group wasn't that bad. I had some problems with them. There was a whole group of King James only Baptists there. There's about 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of them, and their signs were humongloid. I mean, they were just, they were twice the size. They would be, I'd say they're about 12 feet tall. I mean, you could whack somebody over the head with one of these things and just put them out cold. They were just massive. One of them had a King James Bible stomping on people, and they're being cast into hell and all this other wonderful, fun stuff. And one of those guys even told me at one point, he said, hey, I don't preach love. People need to know they're sinners. Just like, oh, so half a message is better than, anyways. So they were there, and the only problem I had with them, I had some discussions with them, and as soon as they found out I wrote the King James only controversy, they really weren't interested in continuing those conversations. But the thing that bothered me about them was there was a period of time where this little Mormon girl tried to come up and talk to him, and this one guy just started mocking her in front of everybody. And it was at a time when big crowds were coming by, and so there'd be people who were standing there, large groups of people who'd be standing there. And this guy just, oh, his attitude. Oh, it was horrible. Not only was he mocking this little girl, but then, little girl, I would say 16, maybe something like that. But then when she left, as well she should have, he'd stand there and he'd say, I would like to introduce you to this. It's a Bible. I know it's a rare commodity here in Salt Lake City because you folks don't read it or believe it, but this is a Bible. And before you go into that building, I want you to hear what this Bible says, because you folks don't read the Bible or know anything about the Bible. And I would like to ask any one of you Mormons to come over here and show me where this Bible says that you can become a god with your own planet. And he's just going on and on and on, and I'm just staying there, just getting a headache. And when we went to lunch, it was so bad that I had decided that when I came back from lunch, I was going to walk up to that guy and I was going to tell him, I am not a Mormon, however, I am so angry about the way you have been treating people today. I'm going to role play one, and I'm going to rip your lips off. I didn't need to. As soon as we got back from lunch, lo and behold, a fellow that I've talked to forever. I've talked to this guy over and over again. There he is. He's got them both. And they are dumbfounded. Here, this guy's sharp. He's sharp. And the only reason he's ever gotten angry with me is because of the fact that I can throw the Greek and Hebrew at him, and he likes to throw Greek and Hebrew out, but he doesn't know it. So I'm always able to catch him on stuff. And so that's where we've had success with him in the past. Well, these guys, they're King James only. Greek and Hebrew, who needs that? And I stood close enough to listen. And this Mormon toasted these two guys, just toasted them. And I never stuck my, the only time I said anything, it was a pretty quiet time, and the Mormon had said, well, you know, we do have the passage in Romans 10 where we are joined heirs with Christ, and I just sort of said, that's Romans 8. Oh, yeah, that's right. Anyways, he he went forward from they went he kept them going for about 2 hours, I would say. And I just thought that was just wonderful. Anyways, that's the one group that was there, and then you had the Fundamentalist Mormons, but that wasn't the most interesting group. The most interesting group that you could see from far, far away was Fred Phelps. Yeah, Fred Phelps. You know Fred Phelps. He has the website. He's the one who goes around protesting homosexuals. He's the one. He's the hate monger against homosexuals. And he was there with his people. It was disgusting. I'm going to tell you, it was disgusting. Try to picture this. We took pictures, and we'll do something with the pictures, but there's, how many were there? Maybe a dozen, I'd say. They have these brightly colored signs, neon colored, orange, yellow, green. Okay, the kind that don't look very pretty, but you can see them from a long ways off. I'm not gonna even repeat some of the things that were on these signs. One guy's holding a sign with a big old arrow says, "This way to hell," pointed into the Mormon church. And that was, you know, somewhat witty. But most of them, just unbelievable. And some of these are being held by little kids. Like one of the signs is, "Person dies of AIDS, God laughs." And there's these little kids, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. That are holding these signs. And I'm sitting here reading some of these things, and it's just, they're holding an upside down flag. Some of their signs say God hates America. And they're standing outside here, and the first thing I ask is, why are they here? And one of the Mormon security guys, they know who we are. They're not concerned about us. They know we're not going to cause any problems. Says, well, Soul Force was supposed to be here. Now, Soul Force is the group headed up by Mel White. And Mel White is the former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and Jerry Falwell and all these folks who came out of the closet and is a homosexual. And he wrote a book, I'm sitting here looking for it, Stranger at the Gate, that's right. And on being gay and Christian in America, I think is the subtitle or something like that. And they were supposed to be there, Soul Force was supposed to be there, to put pressure on the Mormon leadership to accept homosexuals into the leadership of the Mormon church and stuff like that. Yeah, like that's going to happen anytime soon. So since Phelps and his people found out about this, they were there to protest against them. Well, Soul Force never showed. Somebody showed up. A couple lesbians and one homosexual showed up with the rainbow flag and stood far away, and I never heard them say a word. They didn't have any signs or anything. They just sort of stood there. But Soul Force didn't show up. Didn't stop Phelps and the boys. They were going to protest anyways. So I went over to Reverend Phelps. That's what he calls himself. They're out of Topeka, Kansas, if you're familiar with him. One of the reasons I did is once Rich gets back and he can dig himself out from underneath the mountain that's waiting for him, we will be making the debate available in regards to homosexuality with Barry Lynn. And Mr. Lynn asked me during cross-examination, "Have you ever condemned Fred Phelps?" And I said, "I've never met Fred Phelps." Well, now I've got my chance. Here's my chance to meet Fred Phelps and to talk to him. I'm looking at these signs, and so I go over to him. And I told him, I gave him some background. I said, I'm a Reformed elder in a Reformed Baptist church. And the look he gave me was strange. The look he gave me was, show up in Salt Lake City. One of the two. Anyways, and I told him about the debate with Barry Lynn. And then I told him about the book, The Same-Sex Controversy, coming out with the Bethany House Publishers. So he was aware of the fact that I'm not a Mormon. I'm a Baptist. I'm opposed to homosexuality. And so on and so forth. And so he has the material right there. After introducing myself, here's all I said. This is what I'm standing right in front of him. He's I don't know. He's around 70-ish, maybe in the 60s. I'm not really sure about my height. Certainly not my weight. And so I look at him and I say, now, Mr. Phelps, looking at your signs here, we are told in Scripture that we are to speak the truth in love. And as soon as I said the word love, he goes, you're a God-hater and you're going to hell. And two of his people descend on me and just start screaming at me. I mean, they are immediately between me and him. It's. I think it may have been a signal. I think assigning me to the flames of perdition immediately for daring to quote a scripture passage. I mean, the scripture does say we're to speak the truth in love. That's biblical. But as soon as I quoted that, boom. They're on top of me like I just couldn't believe it. I mean, these people just ooze hatred. They wouldn't know Christian love if it walked up and smacked them in the face. I mean, which Christian love probably wouldn't do anyways, but you get the point. They're just absolutely so far out there. It's a cult. I mean, Fred Phelps and his bunch, as someone just described them, sorry bunch, it's a cult. It is absolutely a whacked out cult. There's no two ways about it. I mean, this guy is the worst thing that has happened to the attempt to actually speak the truth about homosexuality as anything could be. And they would not stick around during the quiet times. They'd get in these pretty nice cars, a whole lot nicer than I got. And then they'd come back when the rush was on later on. And every time Phelps would come back, he'd have a different football jersey on. It was really weird. So they were there. And that, of course, complicated things. You couldn't get a tract passed out for nothing. As long as those people are standing there doing their screaming, these ladies would stand on top of the homosexual flag while holding the American flag upside down and sing. In fact, we're sitting here watching these folks getting in people's faces, yelling and screaming at them. And as we're leaving to go to lunch, I think it's about 1:30, they're still there. And as we're walking away from them, we hear that the ladies are singing, Wonderful Grace of Jesus, da 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 da, and we're sitting here going, what are they doing? They're not talking about grace to anybody. What are they singing this thing? It made for an interesting trip to Salt Lake City. There is no two ways about it. It was something else. So, oh, Fred Phelps and the boys and girls there at Salt Lake City made for a fascinating. We took advantage of it. What we'd do? We'd see people will stand there looking at these signs. One of them was graphic. One of them, literally using stick figures, was graphically showing sodomy. Okay, that's kind of the stuff that's there. If you go on their website and you can figure out where it is. You can see this picture. It's in some. I looked at some of the pictures they have of their protesting on the site, and you can see one of these pictures they had. And people just stand there, you know, not very close to them, but they'll stand there, you know, 10, 15 feet away, just in amazement.
And I'd move around, and I'd come stand next to people and go, can you believe it? And they look at me like, no, I can't. What? And we'd start talking. And I'd immediately be able to differentiate myself from them and then say, you know, we've been coming up here for, this is my 33rd general conference, and we're trying to share the gospel with folks, and these people come along. And it gave us an opportunity to witness to some folks. So we, you know, what's the old saying? If somebody hands you lemons, make lemonade, or something along those lines. It was quite the fascinating experience. So then we drove back the next day. That was another wonderful long 654-mile trip. And of course, that was right as the United States launched military operations over in Afghanistan. And so we're sitting here trying to find radio stations in southern Utah. There's a joke for you. not much there. Not much between Panguitch and Page. Just wide open spaces. Not much in the way of civilization, I can guarantee you that. So anyways, that was why we were not on the air last week. So that's our report on the subject of that. Let me just mention something really quickly. We've got two callers at 866-854-6763. And just want to make sure everyone is aware of the fact that we right now are promoting something I've mentioned on the Dividing Line before. On our main page, we have the Roman Catholic Response Pack, I think is what I called it. I'm not sure. The books by Bill Webster and David King are finally available. They are finally, I'm sitting here looking at them right now. The three-volume, 1,100-page work, Holy Scripture. It is a defense of Sola Scriptura. The first volume is on the biblical defense of Sola Scriptura. The second volume is on the historical defense of Sola Scriptura, including the canon of Scripture. And the third volume is an entire discussion of, it's citations from early church sources on the sufficiency of Scripture, so on and so forth. These are available on our website, $57.50 for the, it's $65 retail. We have them for $57.50. However, there's another book. Eric Svensson's book, Who is My Mother, from Calvary Press, has just come out. It is an extensive biblical discussion of the role of Mary in the New Testament. 334 pages in length. And I think you will very much enjoy this work. And so what we've decided to do is put these three works, which is a total of five volumes, over 1,844 pages. All of these available in one offer on our website. And you can get the three volumes from Bill Webster and David King, the new volume from Eric Svensson, my work on justification by faith, the 400-page hardback from Bethany House Publishers, and you can get them all for $89.90, I believe, about $90. Yeah, yes, shipping is above that, but I dare you to go find it anyplace else for that amount of money. You're not going to be able to do it. That's an incredibly good price. 1,800-plus pages of brand new materials on the subject. Now, my book on justification is just on justification by grace through faith. It's not specifically in regards to Roman Catholicism, but obviously, if you've ever dealt with Rome, you know that's a vital, vital issue. And so these are available on our main page at aomin.org. That's an excellent opportunity. If you already have, for example, my justification book, honestly, if you put the $57.50 together with what we charge for the Svensson book, you're almost getting my book for free. So if you already have my book, get another one and give it to your pastor, or get the whole thing for your pastor. I honestly think the people who listen to this webcast especially are the people who know the importance of being prepared apologetically. Therefore, you should, I think, be the very people who in thinking toward the holidays, for example, or even if it wasn't regards to holidays, put these books in the hands of your pastor. Do something for the elders of your church. I know most elders spend lots of money on books anyways. Give them this material. Make sure that they have this material at their disposal. These aren't the kinds of books that are going to be sitting in the front windows of Christian bookstores around the United States. That's we recognize that. That's just, you know, these ain't the Prayer of Jabez. These aren't books that are going to be telling you through three easy steps you can lose all your weight, grow your teeth in straight, get rid of the gray in your hair, and all the rest of that stuff. That's what sells these days. We're well aware of that. For that remnant out there that's still concerned about biblical truth, these books are something you simply have to get for your pastors and have to make it available to them so they'll have that information available to them. 866-854-6763. We'll go ahead and take our break and then bring our callers online and talk to you as well. 866-854-6763 is the phone number here on the Dividing Line. And we'll be taking a number of different questions today. We've got a question about Islam. We've got a question about baptismal regeneration. And whatever questions you will be coming up with at 866-854-6763. But before we get to that, we'll be taking our break and coming back with the last half hour. Please don't be one of those folks that sits there and waits until the very, you know, calls in with 5 minutes left and we don't have time to do anything. If you want to ask a question, have any comments on our trip up to Salt Lake City, any comments on anything else that's going along, anything else I've mentioned, the books, if you'd like to know some more about what the new books cover and how you might be able to use them, go ahead and give us a call, 866-854-6763. We'll be right back. And welcome back to The Dividing Line. My name is James White, and that was that was my break. So we had one technical difficulty today. Not too bad for our first shot at this without Maestro Rich at the controls. So let's go ahead and go to our callers, and let's see if we can start off with Mike in Seattle. Mike, you there?
Right here, James. Thanks for taking my call.
How you doing?
Good. Listen, I was listening to your internet show on archive here about a week or so ago, and you had talked about building your library on Islam, and I've used many of your suggestions in terms of building my library. I wonder what things you've come up with to date that might be valuable resources for us.
Well, there's a number of things that I'm tracking down over time. It is interesting that many of them are taking their time in getting to me, actually. Basically, the first thing that you need to get hold of is the various translations of the Quran. And I'm looking around. I didn't... here it is. Probably the best one, certainly the easiest to get hold of, is the one by Ahmed Ali, a contemporary translation by Ahmed Ali. But just like with anything else, multiple translations will be very useful because some of them are good and some of them are bad. This one has both the Arabic as well as the English in it. And this one I actually picked up at a local, it's published by Princeton, local Barnes & Noble or something along those lines. And I've got some leather-bound copies coming, and I want to be able to do some comparison, especially in regards to the fact that Arabic is not a language that I can read as yet. I have ordered a basic grammar because I think there is a need to be able to engage some of the translational issues and be able to at least read through some of the Arabic. So I'm going to be doing something along those lines. I've also picked up a manual of Hadith because of the fact that so much of the differences between the various groups is due to their interpretation of the traditions that come allegedly from Muhammad. And that really is one of the big issues that I think is going to be difficult to work through as an outsider, is to figure out exactly how to work with this type of information. That's going to be a tough one to work on. Then, and a lot of these I simply got from, by the way, from got online and started going through Amazon. I started going through Barnes & Noble. I started going through, was it Islam. Let me bring up my favorites. Yeah, Islam.com has a store associated with it that you could actually bring up as well, and there's things there. And so I've been picking up all sorts of things, including Introduction to the Study of the Holy Quran by Maulana Muhammad Ali, a Dictionary of Islam, being an encyclopedia of the doctrines, rites, ceremonies, and customs, together with the technical and theological terms by Thomas Patrick Hughes. A lot of these are British. Mm-hmm. Because Britain, of course, has all sorts of Muslims in it. In fact, I think it's the largest minority religious group in Britain.
Right, now. We were over there this summer, and yeah.
Yeah, they're all over the place.
Are you familiar with Bob Morey's ministry at all?
Yeah, somewhat familiar with some of what he's done. I've seen arguments about one of the big things that he argues in regards to Allah being an ancient moon god or something along that line. But I've heard pros and cons from both perspectives there. Right now, what I'm gathering is primarily the, and I've done this with almost every group that I've studied. I start with their stuff first.
With the primary source.
I start with the primary sources, and then I move from there. I need to know the Quran. I need to know the Hadith. I need to know what their major groups, how they interpret it, and then I can start looking at it from there. So I've got Ali's translation of the Quran, Nuruddin's translation of the Quran, and that's basically where I'm starting from there. I do have the standard stuff from, you know, I've got Geisler's work on Islam and things like that. But as far as tracking that stuff down, that then gives me a base from which to work to look for the references that they use, and hopefully start getting a feel for, you know, it's like studying, you don't study quote-unquote Christianity, because the world looks at that and throws in the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses and everything else, and there's all sorts of different perspectives. Got to start getting a feel for what the solid stuff is out there and what the not-so-solid stuff is, because apologetically, especially, there seems to be some real major problems with the Muslim apologetic, but I've also been told that some Muslims who have debated some leading evangelicals have simply cleaned their clocks. Now, I'm not sure if it was because those people weren't prepared or they just addressed the wrong subject or what it was. I don't know.
Well, didn't you have a debate, though?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it wasn't even close. I mean
is that, in fact, I was looking at your website, is that debate available?
Yeah, it's don't know that I can I'm on the same connection that we're live streaming with, so I hope I don't blow us off the air by utilizing it, but where would that be? It might be under general apologetics. It's with Hamza Abdul Malik, so right. If you can just do a search on the site for Malik, it should bring it up. And in fact, I showed that to my high school classes over the past couple of weeks and let them determine who had, in point of fact, won or so on and so forth. I'm looking here probably under affirming the faith, maybe. Let's see here. Biblical doctrine of salvation, predestination, eternal security, maybe not. It's there someplace. I'm looking for it, and I'm not seeing it. It is available because I've seen people filling orders for it. I thought it might be under the Trinity or something along those lines, but maybe somebody in the channel would also be able to track it down.
One last question for you, and this is off the topic of Islam. Are you familiar with a ministry by Alan Morrison? He wrote a book called The Serpent and the Cross.
No, doesn't ring any bells at all.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right, it ties more into New Age. Peter Jones, you're familiar with Peter Jones out of Westminster?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, kind of along the same lines as Peter Jones.
Okay.
He's had some interesting takes on the issue of September 11th, and his feeling was, which I think many times Christians are criticized for, his feelings are more conspiratorial in terms of the New World Order, shadow government, that sort of thing.
Mm, okay.
I didn't know whether that was something
not familiar with it at all.
Yeah.
Not familiar at all. I did find the thing for you, though.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it's on. It's in the bookstore under miscellaneous topics.
Oh, great.
So our miscellaneous section features. So if you go to the bookstore,
yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, and then if you go from there, it's on the right hand side, and yeah. it does New Testament teach the deity of Christ.
Well, I I'll let you go after this, but I just want to say that your ministry has had a big impact in my life. In fact, I've used your books as kind of a starting point and started teaching classes on Mormonism at our church. I've recommended your book on Potter's Freedom. I've got your new book. I think you had a great idea. I think this is Pastor Appreciation Month, and I think that was a great idea for pastors in terms of the Roman Catholicism. I just have been very impressed with the work you've done, and certainly pray that you'll continue to be a blessing to all of us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those prayers with the two young ones going into the teenage years and my teaching at their school, my time has absolutely disappeared. It's been pretty hectic of late, that's for sure. But I appreciate that encouragement. It always helps me to press on. So hopefully you can pick up that that debate. Is get the video if you can't, not
okay.
The audio, because
right.
the video has some fascinating stuff in it. It really does.
All right,
okay,
thanks
for calling.
All
right. God bless. Bye-bye. 866-854-6763. I tell you, anytime you pick up the debate, the video of the debate between myself and Hamza Abdul-Malik, you get to the end and you get to the audience questions, and the camera pans down the people who are standing there at the microphone waiting to ask questions, all but one of which are asked to me. I can't describe it, but it was an experience I will never, ever, ever forget. Well, anyways, 866-854-6763. Let's talk to Johnny of In-N-Out Burger fame. Has a question concerning baptismal regeneration. And someone told me, I forget who, it was Sisygus that told me that anyone who compares McDonald's to an In-N-Out Burger is a moron or something along those lines. And I said, I'm sorry, but I had one of those things, and I'll take a quarter pounder with cheese any day of the year. Okay, that's just all there is to it. I don't understand the attraction, but it has something to do with California. So that's just all there is to it.
Well, most of our stores are here.
Way
most of our stores. We got some in Arizona, but most of them are here.
Well, I know, and the line is forever out here, and I do not understand it. But that is simply from all the transplanted Californians who haven't really, you know, picked up their, you know, their taste yet. So, anyways, yes, sir.
Well, my question has to do with baptismal regeneration, but I do want to ask a side question also on the Muslim religion, if I could.
Okay.
My, you know, I've been studying the issue of Roman Catholicism, as you know. I've learned certain things, like the early church fathers. You look at guys like Augustine, John Chrysostom, and then you go up to the Reformation with a guy like Martin Luther, or even in the Middle Ages with guys like Thomas Aquinas. Now, I don't agree. Obviously, you and I both don't agree with some of the things that Martin Luther said and taught, along with Aquinas and Chrysostom and Augustine. But are we to view the errors that they made? Like, if I look at an Augustine, you know, I go to Christian bookstores and I'll find Augustine's Confessions or et cetera. Am I to look at Augustine from your perspective, as a Christian whom had doctrinal errors, or should I say, Augustine, you believed in baptismal regeneration, that's another gospel, you're a heretic, or how am I to approach this issue? Because I'm, you know, from the understanding that, you know, you got Anglicans, Episcopalians, Lutherans, and God knows who else also believes in baptismal regeneration. Is this something that is an error but can be within the walls of what we consider to be Christianity? In other words, you haven't compromised the gospel completely anyway, or something like that.
Yeah, that's a tough question, and it is one that everyone, I think, has to think through and does think through when they start addressing this particular subject. And I think the first thing to note is that, at least for a number of those people, they attempt to differentiate between what they're saying and the simple idea that the child who is baptized is automatically sealed and signed and on their way to heaven. And some do it in the sense of speaking of faith. You know, Luther tried to come up with infantile faith and things like that so as to maintain justification by grace through faith alone. Others have tried to, you know, Augustine understood it to be in regards to election, that a person who was not elect and was not given by God that gift of perseverance would not enter into his presence, and hence a non-elect infant who is baptized is just made wet by the experience but is not truly regenerated and redeemed in the sense that the elect are, and each one of them involves the impact of tradition upon a person's theology. And
could you just say, I remember a debate that you did against James Aiken on Christian Answers.
Yeah, it wasn't a debate. Everybody keeps calling it that, and I keep saying, if it's a debate, I get the same amount of time, and I didn't get near the same amount of time.
No, so. I'm talking about Christian Answers.
Oh, okay, on eternal security, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And one of the things that James Aiken said was that both Martin Luther and Augustine believed in two kinds of predestination. One was a predestination to initial salvation, and the other was a predestination to complete salvation, you know, from beginning and to the end.
Well, it's hard to identify what Luther's view was because it depends on which Luther you're talking about. I mean, the earlier Luther and the later Luther and so on and so forth. But and the same with Augustine. I mean, Augustine had two different views as well. So I suppose you could say that where they held at the same time is more of a problematic issue. Augustine certainly had the idea of a person who could, and whether he would include them as being truly redeemed in the sense of being a new creature, I don't know. But he certainly had the idea of a person who can act as a Christian and be involved in the church, so on and so forth, who is not predestined to have the gift of perseverance. He certainly did believe that God predestines all of his elect to have the gift of perseverance. And so one might argue, well, if you're not given the gift of perseverance, are you truly one of the elect anyways? And that's, I can't answer that question. I don't know. Because Augustine went through a lot of different phases, and certainly during his fighting with Pelagius, he would be in a different position than he was when he was arguing with the Donatists, for example. And so that kind of inconsistency in Augustine I've used many times as an example of the role of tradition overthrowing the role of exegesis. And so with both of them, you go, okay, well, where do you cross the line? At what point do you get across the line and say, well, no, Augustine could not have possibly been a Christian because of the fact that Augustine believed X, Y, or Z. And I think basically the place I draw the line is a person can have a misunderstanding on something that's even very important if the positive element of faith only in Christ and the grace of God only is there, then the negative element may or may not cause them to cross that line. The problem is that the positive element is there. I don't know how the negative element would automatically become an internal self-contradiction. And that, you know, people will say, well, you can't have any internal self-contradictions. Well, I think we all do. We're just not aware of them. I think any one of us has places where tradition is still impacting our thinking. Ignorance is impacting our thinking. And that's why we have to keep going to the Word and keep growing and increasing in the knowledge of and grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. So it's a lifelong process, and if absolute perfection is what is required, none of us are going to make it. So in light of that...
I thought the Pope was infallible.
Yeah, well, you know, and they would even say he doesn't necessarily have an infallible understanding of all the faith,
right.
Even at that point. So in light of that, I would say, well, that's why I prefer to deal with theologies rather than theologians. That is, I don't have the ability to draw that line perfectly in regards to individuals. But the perfect straight edge that we're to use is Scripture, and there you deal with theologies. And I basically try to recommend to people, you know what? We can't get back into someone's heart. You know, I can't tell people today. I can't look at someone today and know whether that person's profession really represents what's in their heart or not. So if I can't tell with living people, certainly I can't do it with dead people either. And so what I try to tell people is, look, let's talk about the theology. Let's talk about what is clear and not what is unclear. And so I'm hearing something in the background that sounds like our closing music or something, but we're not anywhere near there. So that's an interesting experience. Are you playing something in the background?
No.
Well, then, Mr. Warren, you've got something going back there, and you need to shoot it. That's all I can say. Anyways, I'll sort of talk louder over the pretty music that's in the background somewhere. Hey, it's John Tesh. It's the starting music. There it went. Anyways, in light of all that, I just say, look, the way to be clear here is to focus upon what the Word focuses upon, and that's the teaching, that's the doctrine, not... this person, he held contradictory views, therefore, what's God going to do with him? You know who can take care of that the best?
Well, that's God. You know what? I mean it in a different sense. I mean, for example, I don't think that you as a Reformed Baptist pastor would allow, say, Robert Sabin, the one that's Pentecostal you debated on the Trinity, preach at your pulpit. I don't think
no, of course
that.
Not.
Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't with Martin Luther.
Well, that's not. I sort of doubt that in today's situation. If you're asking today, would we at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church have a Lutheran who believed in baptismal regeneration preach from the pulpit? Probably not. No.
Well, let me take that back. let me put it this way: John Calvin. Preaching at Westminster.
John Calvin would have had us all banished, so I don't think he would have wanted to preach at our
church.
I'm
talking about a Presbyterian, like with R.C.
Yeah.
Sproul.
Yeah, no, sure, we wouldn't have any problem in having R.C. Sproul preach at our church. He just never would, because your church has to see at least 5,000 for him to go there.
Ah.
And our seat's about 250, so...
So you wouldn't consider, I mean, as a pastor... You wouldn't consider Martin Luther, though you disagree with his theology, you wouldn't consider him a heretic, whereas you would see someone like Pelagius as a heretic or Arius.
Yes,
Okay.
Well, that would be true. With Luther, Luther had some problems, but Luther had the positive emphasis on justification by faith down. And when he preached baptismal regeneration, it was with all these 16 billion caveats on it. And he understood the necessity of grace. He understood the bondage of the will. And so I do fully expect to see Martin Luther in heaven. But again, I'm not going to hang my hat on that because that's not within my capacity. When someone raises the issue of what Martin Luther taught, now we can start talking about issues. We can start going to baptismal regeneration. We can start talking about whatever. We can go to the Word where it's certain. Talking about what he himself personally believed, you'll find all sorts of Lutherans who disagree with one another as to what Martin Luther actually believed. And so since they disagree with one another as to what he actually believed, that becomes somewhat of a problematic thing that really, I don't know, necessarily has a response, has anything that really, why in the world waste our time on that? We have got so much other stuff to be doing, so much other work to be doing. You know, I, for some stupid reason, have logged on to a Roman Catholic bulletin board in the internet, and I'm actually writing some responses. I don't have time to do that, but I like to hear what people are saying. It keeps my mind going. It keeps, and there's a witnessing opportunity there. So I'd rather be doing that, spending my time on that, than going, well, you know, during this period of his life, he seemed to believe this. But then during this period of his life, he seemed to believe this. And, you know, where does that mean he's going to end up? I don't know. I leave it to God.
Do I have enough time to ask you that question on Islam?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. I don't know if you got any other callers waiting.
Nope, I don't.
Okay. On Islam. I was speaking to a lady. I don't know if Rich threw at you that the idea that I was going to be involved in starting a new church, and since then I joined the Trinity Reformed Baptist Church.
Great.
Over in La Mirada.
Great.
And my pastor likes you a lot.
Well, I like him a lot.
And one of the conversations that I had with her, we started talking about Islam. With her and her husband, who was the pastor, they're doing the thing, their thing over at my Uncle Byron's house. And she said that she saw on a channel, I don't know what it was on cable, and they were talking about the history of the Muslim religion.
Yeah, it's actually a PBS thing.
Oh, PBS?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And she said that Muhammad seemed to have been a peaceful man that was touched by God and on and on, and that later on, that actually the people he was around didn't like him, and that after he died, I guess he was killed or something, his followers changed his doctrines and made him out to be something that he really wasn't. That he, because the reason why I asked this question is because the previous caller was talking about Dr. Bob Morey, and I met Dr. Bob Morey back in August over at the a church where he was teaching a class. And in the front of the building where he was teaching, there was some magazines, and the magazine is called Believe It or Else, and it's on the Muslim religion, and he writes it, I guess. And basically, he was giving up some quotes in the class where I think the whole Quran, I'm assuming, is one book written by Muhammad. I don't know much about it. And he said that Muhammad wrote in the Quran that if a Muslim were to kill a non-believer, a non-Muslim, it would not be wrong, that they believe that a non-Muslim is an infidel.
Yes, that's somewhat simplistic, but yes, the Quran definitely says that. The problem is the Quran is a highly self-contradictory work. Made up of different surahs written at different points of Muhammad's life. And those surahs are in no way, shape, or form consistent with one another. So there are positive statements about the people of the book. That's the Christians. There are statements that say that if they will do what has been given to them in the Torah and the Injil and the Gospel, that they will be rewarded by God. But then there's other sections that say they believe in, for example, the Trinity, even though it misrepresents the Trinity, that they will be severely punished. And so you can find stuff about infidels being bathed in the flames of hell, and within a few pages find stuff about people who are not Muslims but who are faithful to what's been revealed to them being rewarded by God. So a lot of it comes down to what your tradition becomes, and of course with the Shiite Muslims who believe in mullahs, in imams, who in essence are not actually prophets, but they are guided by God in their interpretation of the Quran and so on and so forth. They then will pick their parts, which would include the bathing of infidels in the flames of hell, and your Sunnis, your more moderate Islam Muslims who don't have their imams and things like that, will pick the other ones. That's what's happening here in the United States, where we're being told that Islam means peace when it means submission.
But one thing I don't understand, though, because you know I'm under the understanding that among Muslims there's a great diversity of view, just as there is among Christians and Jews, etc. And
part of it's due to the inconsistencies of the Quran,
right? But the thing is, many people say that the Bible contradicts itself. Now, you, of course, and myself, believe in the inerrancy of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
are there Muslims that are maybe quote-unquote fundamentalists or something which believe in the inerrancy of the Quran, or do they admit that they'd have errors?
To my knowledge, all Muslims, except the most liberal of them, believe in the inerrancy of the Quran without any question. It was delivered word by word from Allah through Gabriel to Muhammad. That's not the issue. The issue is the interpretation of those inerrant words and the ability to massage what are obvious contradictions into non-contradictions. Now, people say, well, you got to do the same thing with the Bible. The difference is that the Bible in so many places is based upon historical realities. If you read the Quran, you read the Bible, you discover that basically the only literature that really... It's a little bit like some of the wisdom literature, like maybe Proverbs or something. It's a little bit like some of the apocalyptic literature. But you don't have, for example, the kind of prophecy in Isaiah that's rooted in history that allows you to define it clearly as to what it was talking about. You don't have that same kind of thing. You don't have the kind of didactic Sermon on the Mount, Paul writing to the Ephesians type stuff. It really partakes of a very different kind of literature than what you have in the Bible, and hence it is not it's really not subject to the same kind of strict historical either confirmation or disproof. It works both directions. The sword's a two-edged version, shall we say, and so it's much more difficult to deal with on that level. In regards to alleged contradiction, we're talking more here on doctrinal contradiction. And in light of that, that's the reason for all of these different viewpoints is Muhammad went through all sorts of different stages, all sorts of different perspectives. And, you know, if the Christians had made him mad that day, well, lo and behold, the message from Allah would be that they're going to be bathed in the flames of hell that day. You know, it's just sort of, it actually parallels is some of Joseph Smith's revelations.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Yep.
How does this square up with what you said, that, because I didn't see this special on television. It was the lady that I spoke to and her husband, the ones that are starting the church, and they called it the Castle of Christ. And she was saying that she believed, at least based on what she heard on the show, if it's the same one that you're talking about, that he really was touched by God. That's assuming that what they said on the show was accurate.
Well, PBS is always going to give you the perspective that, well, what really happened was Muhammad was this really nice guy and his followers corrupted his teachings just like Jesus, is what they're basically saying. But that's really not, I think, a position that can be verified historically. So, well, hey, you hear the music in the background. Thanks a lot for your call today. Go get yourself a real good burger over at McDonald's there, big guy. And we'll talk to you again. Thanks for calling today. God bless.
God bless.
Thanks to all of you listening in. Thank you, Mr. Warren. Superman has arrived to save the day. We made it through. We're all in one piece. Thank you very, very much. Yes, Rich did call in on his cell phone and help us, but hey, we still got it done. Thanks for listening tonight, and God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-0318 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. for The Dividing Line.